From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1531 in papers written by Benedictine monks in an abbey in France called Saint-Hilaire. In these papers, they're writing about their wine called Blanquette, but something is different. Wine, of course, had been around for centuries, most of it not all that good, according to the ageless Robert Parker. But until 1531, we hadn't seen wine made this way, with the material necessary to produce a secondary fermentation in the flask, leading to bubbles, sparkling wine. Now, this was a century before Dom Perignon himself was born, long before wild stories became accepted legends. Whatever happened in 1531, we know this: sparkling wine would become a worldwide staple in the beverage scene. So, why is it that so often we only drink sparkling wine celebrating occasions? Isn't it pretty much perfect for most foods? And here's another question. Years ago, I wrote about grape growing in relation to Superman. I wrote that you can grow any grape just about anywhere you want, especially in this country. The law allows that. You can grow it in your backyard if you want. In most places, though, grapes are kind of like Clark Kent. They blend in, they go to work, they make juice, it makes wine, not extraordinary. But wine grapes have phone booths hidden around the world, special places where the wine becomes superheroic. Riesling has a phone booth in Germany, and it turns out, in the Finger Lakes. What about sparkling wine? There's a phone booth for sparkling wine and champagne. Is there another phone booth right here hidden among us? Well, this week, Cornell is hosting its annual Business, Enology, and Viticulture Symposium. This year's focus will be on sparkling wines. The conference itself is aimed at continuing to grow the winemaking capabilities for our region. But this hour, you do not have to love wine to appreciate the discussion. We will talk sparkling wine, yes. We'll talk business, climate change, and more. Some of our guests joining us from the WEOS studios in Geneva at Finger Lakes Public Radio, and we will say hello now to Anna Catherine Mansfield. She is an associate professor of enology for Cornell Agritech at the New York State Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva. Anna Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hans-Walter Peterson is team leader and viticulture extension specialist with the Finger Lakes Grape Program of Cornell Cooperative of Extension. Mouthful titles, guys. I'm trying, Hans. How are you?
Good, Evan. Good to be here.
Good to have you, as always. And Dave Wyman is vineyard manager at Sheldrake Point Winery in Ovid on the shores of Cuca Lake. Dave, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And on the line with us is Kelby Russell, head winemaker for Red Newt Cellars. Kelby, welcome to you as well.
Hey, thank you so much.
All right, Anna Catherine, I'm gonna start with you, because the reason we're talking with you guys this week is you've got this event coming up, this symposium that, to my understanding, is pretty well packed for our listeners who might be interested. But why are you? I want to ask, sort of from a regional identity perspective, why focus on sparkling? Unless, you know, I don't think you would focus on sparkling if you didn't think there is a huge ceiling for what it can be done in this region with it.
No, we wouldn't. And in fact, the short answer is we're focusing on sparkling because the industry asks us to. This is our fifth year with our Bev New York conference. And every year we ask, what do you want us to do next year? And we got the overwhelming majority of responses was, let's do sparkling wine. So we're looking at that both from a viticulture, enology, and marketing perspective, because the marketing, of course, is very important as well.
Kelby Russell, when you travel and you talk to people, different restaurants, different markets, different cities, and you're a Finger Lakes winemaker, what do they know about this region in 2018?
At this point, they know Riesling very well. That's far and away what they're asking for the most. And then, to our surprise, Cab Franc has been a growing interest. We have people who have had our Rieslings and then ask us about Cab Franc time after time, which has led to some shortages on that part. And really, that sort of split has led us to look, if we've got a white and we've got a red, going out there with something else, whether it's dessert or whether it's sparkling, to have a third offering just makes the whole process more stable for a winery.
Well, I'm going to drag you into my hacky analogy there, Kelby, and I will ask you, is there a phone booth for Cabernet Franc in the Finger Lakes?
I'd say there absolutely is. You know, it grows like a weed, which is actually a good sign, because that isn't the case for a lot of grapes. So it's the fact that it seems to excel here in growth habits, the fact that we've had, you know, really a fair amount of time focusing on a grape that's kind of quirky. I mean, people have been working on Cab Franc in the vineyard in the winery since the mid-90s, certainly before, but kind of seriously since the mid-90s. And that's actually a significant amount of time to have spent focusing on that as a varietal wine, as opposed to, you know, as a Bordeaux blender. So it seems to suit us here, and it seems that we've actually given ourselves a bit of an advantage timeline-wise, which isn't always the case for how young the Finger Lakes is.
I promise we're going to get back to sparkling and other matters in a moment here, but when Kelby describes any wine as quirky, I think of Cabernet Franc. Hans-Walter Petersen, if it's quirky but really well-suited to the region, it's probably because it's like your friend in school who never missed a day of school, never got sick, somehow didn't get sick when everybody else got sick, and could quote incredible French poetry and all kinds of things, and you had no idea where it came from. That's sort of what Cabernet Franc is, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. That's quite the analogy. I gotta remember that. It's Cabernet Franc is it's a variety that I think on the surface you would look at it and just kind of think it doesn't seem to belong here in some ways. But I think, you know, one of the most important things for any variety in this, in a region like this, where we're kind of on the edge of kind of some of the grape growing preferences, is being able to make it through winters. And that's one of the things that Cabernet Franc does quite well. It survives our winters pretty well. So that's kind of always one of the first cuts you have to think about. But after that, then it's kind of like, okay, how do we grow it so that it produces really good fruit? And what do we do in the cellar to make sure it makes really good wine? And we've made some incredible strides in that over the past, as Kelby said, since about like the mid-90s or even in the past 10 years or so. We've really started to learn some things, both in the vineyard and the winery, to take that variety and really help it to excel. And like you said, there's not a whole lot of places in the world that make varietal Cab Francs. It's usually made in a blend. So it is kind of a little bit of a niche, and so if we can kind of make that niche work really well for us, that helps the wineries.
Let me ask Hans and then all of our other guests on this subject, because as we talk about what this region is doing, the focus on sparkling wine, which we're going to talk a good amount about this hour, I think it's important to understand the challenges of grape growing in a year like 2018. One of the things that Hans mentioned before the program, I think what you said was even in the last, decade or so, Hans, we've seen our growing season, and there's a technical term which we can get into in a second, but we've essentially seen the growing window open 10% wider. Is that roughly correct in the last decade?
Yeah, basically since the past 10 or 15 years, we've seen kind of the amount of heat that we accumulate during the growing season has gone up by about 10% on an average basis. So it kind of matches up with some of the other climate data that we see about heat during the growing season in general in all sorts of agricultural regions. So it's not just ours. We're definitely seeing, on an average, more heat accumulation during the growing season than we have historically.
And that, you know, does line up with what we're seeing with climate change. But I know, Hans, it's not as simple as saying, well, it's warmer, so it's better. Because I think what I have read from the experts who know much more than I do is it is warmer, yes, but it's also more varied. Is that true?
Absolutely. If you lived in upstate New York, and especially in the Finger Lakes in 2016, you saw a drought that we haven't seen in at least 50 years, if not much more. And then we come into 2017 and we have a lot of farm fields that couldn't get planted in the spring because there was so much water. We had so much rain. And so the variability we are seeing, yes, the averages are changing in some ways, but the variability that makes up those averages is getting much more extreme. And so that's something that growers like Dave and others that I talk to are seeing on a pretty consistent basis. And they don't need data to see that. They see that every day.
Dave, what is an average season like in the Finger Lakes? That's a trick question. There's no average, I know. But people, I'm sure, Dave, will ask you that. And that's one of the really interesting but challenging parts about your job. This is another point, Dave, that Hans made to me before the program. When somebody asks, what's an average? If you're in California winemaking, I know it's getting warmer and it's always challenging wherever you're growing anything, but there are more, you know, seasonal averages to expect. Here, is there ever an average year, Dave?
Once in a while, there's an average year. And that would mean that all of the biological markers land on time and disease pressure is about average and harvest dates are about where you expect them. That doesn't happen very often. So, yeah, more often than not, like as Hans said, it's too wet or too dry these days and the weather events are very close together and it's difficult to manage disease pressure, more so than it was, 10 years ago.
And so, Hans, when it comes to that question for you, how do you typically ask people who don't work in the industry and they say, well, what is an average season like for you guys?
Well, when you, you know, think about what an average is, it's basically taking a certain amount of data, whether it's temperature or rainfall or whatever, and kind of saying, where's the middle of all of those things? But there's a big spread around that. So, you know, I kind of think a lot of us in the industry say there is no average year. There's always seems to be some kind of anomaly that kind of throws things for a little bit of a twist. And one of the things that is always amazes me out here is how adept the growers are at being able to kind of shift their practices in order to accommodate that. Sometimes it means having to do some more hand labor in the field. Sometimes it means having to move up or move back your harvest dates. Sometimes it means having to change some of your pest practices. But you can't just go by, you know, I'm going to do this in the middle of June and this at the end of July and da-da-da-da-da, because as soon as you do that, you'll get thrown off your calendar pretty quick.
Kelby, as someone who's a winemaker in the Finger Lakes, you've got friends and colleagues in places around the world. You have worked in wine regions around the world. How does our region compare when it comes to that kind of variation challenge? I'm sure there are other wine regions that have a lot of variation as well, but from what you're understanding in the field, how do you think our region compares?
I think it splits kind of new world, old world a lot of the time in terms of wine regions and what we consider archetypical new world regions, broadly speaking, Australia, New Zealand, California, and really, I mean, the West Coast. You don't see a huge amount of vintage variability. I mean, there's vintages and there's changes and there's things to keep track of, but in the end, they actually are pretty even healed. In the old world, you see quite a bit more vintage variation. I think that's why, I mean, when we think about Burgundy or Bordeaux, you know, what each vintage gets for a score can really swing based on what the weather brought for that harvest and what challenges they faced. And I think as a winemaker in the Finger Lakes, when we have people visit or help us out in the winery during harvest from Australia or New Zealand, they're kind of astonished at what we're dealing with, especially when it starts to snow when we're pressing grapes. But as the opportunities of that I found out in the market are huge. I mean, it's something unique to be an American wine region that actually has more in common with how the old world practices winemaking and grape growing and the challenges that they respond to. And I think buyers are starting to notice that.
We're talking to a panel of people from the wine industry as we get ready for Cornell's annual Business, Enology, and Viticultural Symposium. That is coming up starting on Wednesday, and this is the fifth year they've been doing it. They're focusing on sparkling wines after the industry asked them to do that this year. The conference aiming to continue to grow the winemaking capabilities for the Finger Lakes region. And Anna Catherine Mansfield, when I read Robert Parker's reviews of those Benedictine sparkling wines from the 1530s, they're brutal. I mean, they're underripe, you know, it's thin, no texture, not nearly enough oak. And you know, there is a little bit of a stereotype about sparkling wines around the world that, well, those are the grapes that you throw into sparkling when they're just not ripe enough for other, you know, for other wines, whether you're going to make Chardonnay or something else, that if they're not ripe enough, I guess you can make rosé, or I guess you can make sparkling. And I know that's way overly simplistic, but let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the perception versus the reality there.
Sure. And, you know, traditionally, yes, if the grapes that you're growing aren't going to be optimized for your whatever your top label is for your winery, you might want to divert those and, you know, not use them for something that you're putting forth as the flagship of your winery. But if you want to produce a very good rosé or a very good sparkling, there are actually specific clones of Chardonnay that you would want to plant. There are specific cultivars that you'd want to grow, and you'd want to optimize the methods, your processing methods, to make those wines rather than have them as an afterthought. So yes, they do exist sort of as an afterthought sometimes, and those can be very good products. But if you really want to optimize the product, you want to think about that a little bit more carefully. And there are various, I know we talked a little bit before on the show, there are various types of sparkling wines that you can make, and each of those requires a little bit of thought as to what grapes you're going to use and what sort of processing you're going to use, whether it's the very traditional method champenois, which is how, or traditional method, which is how champagne is traditionally made. And of course, we can't call it champagne in the U.S. because we're in a different region, but we can make wines the very same way using the champagne method. And that involves harvesting your grapes a little bit earlier, fermenting them differently than you would a Chardonnay that's going to be a still wine, and some other steps like that.
That on that point, by the way, that's a good example of why when people think about sparkling, if they think it is sort of either an elite or expensive product, one of the points I think you want to drive home this week, Anna Catherine, is that there's a diversity of ways to do this, and it doesn't always have to result in an expensive wine, right?
Absolutely, yes. If you think about method Champenois, traditional method, it takes lots of steps. You're doing a primary fermentation in a tank, and then you're moving to bottles, and then you've got to ferment in bottles. There are lots of steps. There's a lot of hand work. So it's always going to be more expensive when you do that method. You're also getting a specific style of wine from that because you're aging on the yeast. Once the yeast dies from the secondary fermentation, you get lots of toasty notes that are different than you would find in a sparkling wine, in a still wine. But there are other sparkling wines like Charmant method or the transfer method, which are the styles that we use to make things like Prosecco, that can be lighter and fruitier and take less time and money to make, so they are more affordable. And we find that the whole range will work here in the Finger Lakes. We certainly have, you know, Chateau Frank and H.J. Weimer, who are making, and I believe Red Newt as well, who are doing some method Champenois, but we've got some lovely Prosecco styles. We've got even some forced carbonation, which you can do by making a still wine that, again, you have to control the parameters of. You wouldn't make it just like you would for a regular still wine, and then force carbonate it with just like you would a Coca-Cola. And those are much less expensive to produce and are light and fruity and fresh and are going to go with a different, you know, it's going to go with your barbecue rather than maybe with your oysters. So we've got a range of products at a range of prices.
Kelby, why not go with the less labor-intensive and less expensive option when making sparkling? Is Red Newt going with sort of the more intensive process?
We're going with the more intensive process because we wanted to highlight one of our single vineyard plots and really build the entire wine around showcasing that particular vineyard and what we thought it would do with those sorts of yeasty aromas and of going through the entire method Champenois process. But there's no reason not to look at the other examples and other styles. You know, I think it's really incumbent on wineries, as we always tell people, that they should open sparkling wine more often to make sparkling wines that are available at price points that actually lend themselves to being opened more often. And, you know, you can bring the price down a certain amount with a traditional method sparkling. But in the end, as Anna Catherine said, there's just so many steps involved, it's impossible to get past that at some point. So these the transfer methods and the forced carbonation, and really the forced carbonation, I would say, is taking off. I think I can't even keep track of how many of those products are hitting the market or about to hit the market this year.
I'm going to turn to Dave Wyman again, who's vineyard manager at Sheldrake Point, because I think, Dave, there's something mildly insulting to a vineyard manager, I would guess, if we just simplify rosé and sparkling products as, well, that's the stuff that you grew that wasn't ripe or good enough for other wines. And first of all, the Sheldrake rosé is consistently, for me, the best, or one of the best in the region, and it is easy to bring as a gift for anybody because it's outstanding. And I think that I've read that you guys have had to plant more space just to deal with that. So why don't you tell me a little bit about, you know, whether it's rosé or sparkling, are you mildly insulted when people assume that's just the underripe stuff?
I should act insulted, shouldn't I?
I'm recommending it.
Okay, thanks. I find our rosé to be a fantastic product that fits both the clientele, the Sheldrake Point image, and what the vineyard can produce very easily. It is analogous to making champagne out of other grapes as well, because it is a little bit less stressful in the vineyard. And that's the point where I should be insulted, isn't it? So, yeah, it is exactly that. It is easier in the vineyard. It takes less time in the winery, and it's a fantastic product. It really fits. There are times when Cabernet Franc will take till sometime in November to get ripe enough to be a good still red wine. It's ready earlier than that for the rosé, and that's a good quality to have. It makes the process a little bit easier. So.
And not to get wonky, Dave, but you know, this is where people who have tried either, you know, sort of growing or know part of the agricultural process would be interested to kind of understand some of what we're talking about here. And it's probably good for me to clarify that as a writer, we get a lot of things wrong with what I'm about to say, because there's this old kind of trope in winemaking that crop more and the wines get thinner, reduce crop and it gets more intense and quote unquote better. And I know that there are diminishing returns, and when it comes to that, that's way oversimplifying it. But one of the reasons I think that, you know, whether it's sparkling or rosé gets sort of maligned is because it's this assumption that, well, you guys can crop the heck out of it, it doesn't matter because it doesn't have to get ripe. And that's, I know that's not true either. So let's tackle some of those stereotypes.
So it is a broad stereotype. It does, if you want to make quality rosé, you have to have quality grapes. And we do crop at a high level at Sheldrake Point, but we should speak more about balance than we should speak about level of crop, because level of crop is not the same for one vineyard to the next. Larger vines need more fruit, and that's where our vines are. We thin in order to get the quality that we want. The grapes that we take to make the red wine later in the season are the same cropping level and this out of the same vineyard as the rosé. The rosé is more about harvesting at the right chemistry for rosé, and then the still red wine from Cabernet Franc is about harvesting at the right chemistry for the red wine. So it is more of a stage of ripeness, because you don't want to lose the acidity that makes our rosé taste so fresh. If you left that acidity in the same grapes for the red wine, it would be out of place in the red wine as well. So that's, I think that answers your question.
Yeah, I think it does. And this is where I think probably Hans-Walter Peterson, through various times throughout the years, I've seen you jump occasionally into threads or conversations in the wine world where writers are a little overly simplistic. But this is where, Hans, I wonder where climate comes in. Because if we are a little warmer or with a little bit longer growing season or a little bit more intense growing season, does that make it more difficult? You know, in other words, does that, if we had too much heat, if we had a 50% boost in heat, what would that do to the efforts to make some of these wines?
I think that one of the biggest things is it changes, as Dave was talking about. I mean, a lot of what happens, especially at harvest time, is about the chemistry, what's going on with sugar and acidity and color compounds and flavor compounds and things like that. All of those things are derived from the photosynthetic process in vines. Vines produce their own food and produce everything that goes into the fruit through photosynthesis. And so if you change the climatic situation that vines are being exposed to, more heat, more sunshine or less sunshine, more rain, less rain, that has an influence on the water and the nutrients and the carbon intake into the vine. And that's going to have an influence on how many leaves you grow, which means how much fruit you can grow, and has an influence on how much acidity and sugar and all these kinds of things. And so as climate changes, we have to look at how are those changes influencing what is happening to the vine, and then how do we give tools to people like Dave and to winemakers like Kelby to understand what does this mean for upcoming harvest? What does this mean for changing character? One of the things that Anna Catherine and her colleague Chris and I talk about a lot is understanding how much kind of foresight can we give to growers and winemakers about what's coming down the pike? I mean, things can always take a wild turn at a moment's notice in a lot of ways. But what are we seeing? If we can give more information ahead of time so that growers and winemakers can kind of have a sense of what's going to be happening, whether that's because of unusual climate situations or something else, then that gives those people a better chance to react and decide which tools out of their toolbox they can pull out in order to make the best product possible.
We have an email from a listener named Adam who wanted to know, isn't climate change good for a region like this? And again, Adam, I appreciate the question. It's not a bad question, but I think it may be a little bit more complex than good, bad. Starting with this, Dave Wyman before the program was saying that, you know, not only are we getting a little bit more heat, but sometimes our nights are warmer. And that is not just as simple as saying, well, I guess we have warmer nights. That impacts disease, right, Dave?
Oh, yes. It's hard to illustrate to somebody who's not in the industry how warmer temperatures at night, when the humidity is so high, it increases disease pressure, I would say, many times. You know, it just takes a little bit of change in humidity and temperature to make things like powdery mildew or botrytis just take off. And warmer nights are detrimental to the industry, and that's what we're getting more of. You know, it's both in vine health or fruit health, and as well as reducing acidity in things like Riesling, which the region is known for. You know, the racy acid in our Riesling. So it's not as simple as warmer is better. It's not. So
yeah, that's where those crisp nights that we sometimes we had to throw a sweatshirt on in the middle of summer, it's actually good for our viticulture out there. Let's ask the rest of our panel on that question. Adam's question, isn't climate change good for a wine region like this? Anna Catherine Mansfield, what do you think?
What's happening with climate change is that we are seeing variation at the beginning and the end of the season, which is when I'm going to probably overstep my knowledge as an enologist rather than a viticulturist. But when we see, you know, late season frosts or early season frosts, we can lose crop. One of the things that we in the Enology Extension Program that we are talking to winemakers about more and more is it does have to do with, you know, reds, and we have a longer season sometimes, and so the reds are getting more ripe, which our winemakers haven't seen as much, they're not as familiar with. But we don't sort of have a good intuitive feeling anymore for when catastrophe might strike, like when the first frost might come, or we might get a bad rain event or something like that. So it becomes nerve-wracking towards the end of harvest if our weather is less predictable to know if we can leave the red grapes, especially on the vine, and let them ripen until November, as Dave mentioned, or if we need to get them off because we might lose them all to some catastrophic weather event.
Okay, Kelby Russell, climate change. Adam's question, is it good for the region?
I think on the aggregate, I would say it's good for the region. I think it, insofar as it presents greater opportunities, but the risks are also higher. So that's kind of the balance of it all. The up and down and the risks and the swings are much more extreme, and you have to be ready to kind of dodge and parry and thrust with what the season sends your way. But in the end, you know, I always go back to there's the trope in the wine world that the best wines come from a cool climate in a warm year. And we're still a cool climate, even though we're warming. And if we have an opportunity at more warm years, we have a chance to make some really profoundly beautiful wines. I mean, I kind of look to what Germany went through in the 70s and 80s, where they had a couple of decades where it was quite cool and they were having trouble making dry Rieslings of great interest, you know, certainly with exceptions. But then as through the 80s and 90s, as it started to warm up for them, it was kind of year after year after year of explosive growth in the quality of those wines and the interest in those wines.
And Hans, I think of years like 2010 and 12, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but this is when people, I think, who don't work in agriculture, in growing, will have a hard time understanding. Wouldn't you want to open that window earlier? And I always think of it like this. If you got to get on and board a train that's going to go, you know, from Rochester to Boston, and you can leave an hour early, but in that hour early window, there's a chance that a wrecking ball is going to take your train off the track. Now, you don't know if it's coming, but if you want to take that risk, you can get on. And if it doesn't come, you get there an hour early, and that's great. That's nice for you. But if that wrecking ball hits you, you don't get there at all. And that's kind of what an early frost is. If we get that early, that March, that super early, you know, warm early April, that's great, maybe, but if frost comes, it wipes the train off the track entirely. So it's nerve-wracking. And I wonder for you if there are certain recent years that kind of demonstrate the possible good potential there, where all of a sudden our window is really long, or the fears that can come with that.
Frost is a wrecking ball. You're coming up with some good ones, Evan. I like this.
Well, you got to be able to communicate, man.
Right. I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, the thing, yes, where some increase in heat accumulation can help with certain ripening aspects of it, especially red grapes, as we've been talking about. But it also, as Dave pointed out earlier, means we have a great deal more variation. If we think back to, I think it's either 2012 or 2013, 2012, we had a stretch of 75 to 80 degree days in mid-March. And we had bud break here at the end of March. Normally, bud break here is early May, late April to early May. So we were over a month ahead of time. And then all of a sudden, then the temperatures went back to where they normally are, which means there was a lot of chance of frost. Amazingly, it was not a complete disaster year for us. There was definitely frost injury out there, but there was still a crop. But it that's the kind of potential issue that we kind of look at when we're talking about climate change. We get these, especially if you get these warmer winters where the vines start to kind of come out of, think it's time to come out of dormancy, think it's getting close to time to, for the buds to start opening up and start growing. And then all of a sudden the weather says, no, we're not quite done with winter yet. And, you know, like you said, the wrecking ball comes through and all of a sudden you lose 50% of your crop in one night because temperatures go to 25 degrees or something like that when you have exposed tissues. So those are the kinds of things we worry about. And in response to those kinds of things, for example, we're seeing a lot more wind machines being installed in the Finger Lakes. 7-8 years ago, there was one farm that had 3 wind machines on it. And now there's probably 20 to 30 of wind machines around here. They're all over the place if you go over to Ontario in the Niagara Peninsula. And we're starting to kind of see those same issues come up. And even though they're a big financial investment, if you save one crop because this machine was able to keep the weather a little bit warmer, down temperatures a little bit warmer, down closer to the ground, it's paid for itself. And so everything after that is gravy. So it's definitely something that's on growers' minds, and growers are starting to do some things about in order to try to keep farming.
All right. So I think to answer Adam's question, you've gotten a lot of great perspective there on the complex ways that climate change is impacting one of the most important economic industries that we have here in Western New York. And I'm going to try, professors, to sum it up here. To Kelby's point that on the aggregate, it's probably a net good is because we will have a little bit more of a window to ripen grapes, to add more intensity, to make what we hope are more enjoyable or better wines. Not to say the wines aren't wonderful now. And that, by the way, not to say that a cool climate is not awesome, which it is. We're not going to become Napa, certainly not right now, not overnight. But that could be helpful. Also, you've got more questions and concerns about disease pressure, which is not a good thing. And you've got the problem for early frost kind of wiping out parts, or in some cases, if it's extreme, all of your crop. And then you can grow all you want and come up with nothing. So all of that variation just means a little more nerve-wracking times for an industry that's already weather-dependent. It could mean some great years, and it could be some really, really tough years. Professors, how did we do?
Sounds perfect to me.
Okay.
Nailed it.
Right on. Yeah.
Talking climate change and Finger Lakes winemaking, and after our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and get back into what brought us here in the first place, because coming up starting on February 28th, that's Wednesday, Cornell is hosting its annual Business, Enology, and Viticulture Symposium, and they're focused on sparkling wines this year. The conference aimed at continuing to grow the Finger Lakes winemaking capabilities, and our guests are talking about that. Hans-Walter Peterson, team leader and viticulture extension specialist with the Finger Lakes Grape Program of Cornell Cooperative Extension. Anna Catherine Mansfield is associate professor of enology for Cornell Agritech at the New York State Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva. Dave Wyman is vineyard manager at Sheldrake Point Winery on Cayuga Lake, and Kelby Russell on Seneca Lake, the head winemaker for Red Newt Cellars. Let's get that break and come back next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, understanding the U.S. relationship with Russia. Our guest has great expertise in this area, can answer many of our questions. That is first hour. In our second hour, the future of EVs, electric vehicles. Would you like one? Would you like to have a charging station at work? How can companies join in that effort? Get more involved with making EVs more possible. We'll discuss it. Welcome back to Connections. Want to say thanks again to our colleagues at WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM throughout the Finger Lakes, their studios hosting our guests for this hour, and they are wonderful partners. Listeners, no matter where you are, that's the wonderful thing about the reach in these partnerships of the NPR member stations here in Western New York. You can go all the way to Ithaca and listen to Connections every afternoon, and we hope you do. So thank you to our friends, Kelly, Greg, the wonderful folks at WEOS and Finger Lakes Public Radio. Got an email from a listener named Martin who writes the following. Evan recently went on a wine tour, and I hadn't been in almost 30 years. I couldn't believe how many wineries there were. I knew some familiar old names, but most of them were places I had never heard of. How many are there, and does this work anymore? Martin is wondering. Martin couldn't believe it. So thank you, Martin, for the email. It's a great question. I'm going to start in the WES studios. Anybody know exactly how many wineries there are in the Finger Lakes now?
I think we are right around 145 in the Finger Lakes,
wow,
depending on how you define the Finger Lakes and how you define a winery. Because we do have some wineries who have, you know, are producing more than one label. So there aren't two physical buildings, but yes.
145, and that's even up from, I want to say it was 8-10 years ago. I think the number was 125. I had conversations, Anna Catherine, with winery owners who thought, well, this is probably the saturation point. You know, this is, it's gotten tough to just exist out of tasting room sales because of just the number, the sheer number of places that consumers like Martin, who emailed the program, can go. Anybody think this is it, that we're at the saturation point, or is there more growth still possible?
Well, this is Anna Catherine. That might, again, depend on who you ask. I think we're seeing more specialization. So we might see that consumers are going to very particular wineries. Instead of going to every winery on the lake, they're looking for particular products. So we may see more segmentation of the market. And also, you know, a real consideration is the roads that we have around here. I mean, if you go up and down the west side of Seneca Lake, you've got a road that's one lane each way. So we certainly are seeing traffic. So physical limitations arguably are in effect. As far as consumer reach, I'm not sure. I wish we had a marketing person in here to answer that question.
Well, I'd like all of you to weigh in on this. Kelby, let's turn to you on this. You think we're anywhere near a saturation point now in the Finger Lakes?
In terms of pure production, I would say we're nowhere close to a saturation point. I mean, I think there might be that's a really good point that Anna Catherine made about eventually hitting a limit of what the infrastructure can handle in terms of visitors. But I think as the region continues to mature, like many regions within the country and around the world, you start seeing the wines going out to market more. And really, by and large, people have kind of focused on selling within New York State and sometimes really just between Rochester and Syracuse for the most part. And there's so many more consumers that are out there that would be interested in the wines that we're making, especially at the price points we make the wines. We're very price competitive with a lot of the wines that we're sending out into the market, that it's hard to think that we're anywhere close to a saturation point there.
But Kelby, do you think in the next 5, 10, 20 years, we will see some producers kind of absorb some others? And here's why I ask. I remember talking to producers at two little regions in France in the Rhone Valley, and they have almost the exact same acreage for wine. But one of these little appellations has like six total wine producers, and the next door, there are like 40. And the ones next door told me that inevitably we're going to see some folding into one another just to kind of give sort of economic power, that it's tough when it's this many small producers, and that inevitably for the consumer, when there's this many smaller producers, the prices are a little bit higher than they would be. So do you think that would change at all, Kelby?
I could see some kind of mergers and combinations happening. I don't think that's quite as likely, just because I think there's still, the price of land is still relatively low, the price of getting into the industry is still relatively low in the Finger Lakes versus a lot of regions. So it's actually, if you want to kind of put out your shingle and start up, it's not as cost prohibitive to try and do that. And you can still hit the market at a decent price point. So that's, I think that would probably be my answer. I think you might see, if I had to guess, I would say you might see more people buying up other wineries just for access to really good vineyard sites. That would probably be the main driver, I would expect.
Interesting. Dave, are you surprised to see 145? I mean, certainly your career started and the number was much smaller than that.
Yeah, that's right. I'm surprised it's 145. That's a real high number. I don't know if that's saturation for distribution. I don't think distribution's affected at all on how many wineries are in the Finger Lakes. That's more or less unlimited. But our tasting room sales haven't changed in 15 years. Same number of people, roughly the same number of sales all through that time. The one other thing I'd like to comment on is if wineries were to kind of gather up together, I think one of the benefits would be a stronger distribution model. If you've got enough size to have a specialized person on distribution and have a large distribution portfolio to push forward, it's going to work better through distribution. So
that's interesting, Dave. I mean, I always thought that for this region, for any region that isn't sort of the big, well-known glamour wine regions, if you want to end up on restaurant lists, if you want to end up just about anywhere on wine shelves, you got to go through the process of becoming first like a secret handshake region that's cool, and then, you know, that the hipster wine lovers love and know, and then, you know, with a higher, you know, probably overall volume of production, a chance to become a little bit more mainstream. Are you, Dave, are you saying that the region is or is not doing a good job with some of the, its leveraging of its resources there?
Perhaps. And I'd also say that it's difficult to get noticed for what you're good at on a larger scale. And those are hurdles that a larger company could do a better job on.
That's very interesting. I really thought that you guys were going to tell me not to start a winery. So Hans, I'm going to hire you. I'm going to hire you, Hans. And the question is this:
right.
Where is there good land for vineyard space that is not currently vineyards? How much does it cost, and what are you going to tell me to plant there?
All depends on your goals and your cash. I mean, there's still plenty of land in the Finger Lakes that has the potential to produce very good fruit, I think. And when we're looking at sites, we're looking at proximity to the lakes, whether it's Seneca or Cayuga or Cuca or Canandaigua or wherever, because the moderating effects of those lakes is one of the real keys to be able to grow grapes here at all. So that's one part, obviously. But there's still plenty of sites that are either just in kind of cash crops like corn and soybeans and dairy, or just open, not used at all. So there's plenty of potential for more vineyards to be planted. Like Kelby said, the price of entry in the Finger Lakes is pretty inexpensive compared to most other places, wine producing regions around the world. I think very rough rule of thumb is that land for a vineyard that's got kind of all those things that you might want is going to run you maybe $10,000 an acre. Give or take. If you said that to somebody 15 years ago in the Finger Lakes, I think they would have laughed at you.
Because
I think
15 years ago it was more like 3,000, wasn't it?
Right.
Okay.
Or
okay.
If 1,000, So it's, but when you compare it to, you know, Napa is $500,000 an acre. Long Island is $50,000 to $75,000 an acre. So, I mean, in the Finger Lakes, like Kelby said, it's still quite inexpensive. As far as varieties to plant, it's totally, I tell people all the time when they're new growers, I said, plant what you can grow and what you can sell, whether you're selling the fruit or selling the wine. So if you can plant 10 acres of, or 5 acres of Riesling and 5 acres of Cabernet Franc and have a market to sell that to, great, do it. A lot of people don't understand how hard agriculture is and grape growing. And so usually when somebody's starting out who really doesn't have any experience in agriculture, I tell them start growing some kind of hybrid. A hybrid grape variety has some built-in disease resistance, better cold tolerance, things like that, can be a more reliable producer with less work. They don't have the fancy names that a lot of people like to think about, like Riesling and Chardonnay, but they're really important producers for our region and can produce some really good wines. One of the most versatile grapes that we grow in the Finger Lakes is a grape called Cayuga White. Variety developed at Cornell almost 50 years ago now. It gets used in, I mean, you're not going to sell a Cayuga White wine for $30 probably, but it gets blended into a lot of products. It gets made into a sparkling wine we were just kind of talking about, and a couple of different places, and it is a really reliable producer. It gets a decent price with low labor costs. So it all depends on kind of what you're shooting for, but there's a whole lot of options in the Finger Lakes, and that's one of the great things about the region is that there's a low cost of entry relatively, but there's also a lot of options that you can look at.
Here's an email, by the way, Hans et al. From a professional obstreperous crank, Peter Bell. He says, Peter writes, he's the winemaker at Fox Run. He says, nobody mentioned the danger of invasive species when it comes to warming in this region. So invasive species, what's the concern there?
Yeah, it's the concern is always that when you change climatic conditions, you're changing both the predator and prey populations. And so if you bring a species in that is not from a region, there's been no kind of evolutionary process for a predator population to build up in response to that. And so when we have something, a an insect, for example, that has been around for a very long time, something like grape berry moth, can cause some damage in vineyards, but there are native kind of small wasps and things like that that can parasitize on those pests. You bring in something like brown marmorated stink bug or spotted winged Drosophila, or this new one that we're getting to hear a little bit more about, the spotted lanternfly in Pennsylvania. There are no natural predators for those right now. And so as climate changes, you get this new invasive that's able to survive in this area, but we're also not necessarily importing an invasive predatory species, which is another invasive species. So it's kind of this weird conflagration. And so I think Peter makes a very good point that's another aspect of a changing climatic situation that we're keeping an eye on.
Got a few minutes left. I want to turn back to Anna Catherine Mansfield to tell us a little bit more about who's coming in this week for Cornell Symposium. It's known as BEV, Business, Enology, and Viticulture. It's running February 28th through March 2nd, so that's coming up from Wednesday through Friday. Who's involved with this, Anna Catherine?
Well, this is the organization of this is a joint effort between my colleague Chris Gerling and I. We're the Enology Extension team, and Hans Walter Peterson. So we had separate meetings for a long time and decided that we were trying to get the same group of people to come to two separate meetings each year. So we joined forces, and that's been really successful, and then called in some of our colleagues from the hotel school at Cornell and the business school in order to give us some business acumen that we don't have. But we've really tried to make it. This meeting is for all the industry members in New York State, so whether you're in the tasting room or in the winery or in the vineyard, and we are trying to get something like continuing education masterclass. We call in academics both from Cornell, where we have a large pool in this this field, but we also have folks coming from Brock. Our keynote speaker in Enology and Viticulture this year is Belinda Kemp, who has worked in sparkling wine in the UK, which is a developing sparkling region, in New Zealand, and now in Canada. She's a fabulous speaker. We have champagne marketer, I believe he's a project manager, coming up from New York City to talk about sparkling wine distribution down there. Gosh, we've got academics coming up from, I believe we have a speaker from RIT, Lorraine Hems. We've got TC3 and any of the universities and other schools in the region who have academic programs.
All right, so a lot coming up this week. And let me grab a phone call. Evan in Rochester. Different Evan. Thank you, Evan. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I've got a quick question about the use of remote sensing in the keeping of vineyards. So I know grapevines require close monitoring as far as moisture content goes to get the proper grape. And I'm wondering, how do you monitor that? Like, do you go out in the field and test the plants?
Okay. Dave, Hans, want to jump there?
So Our big problem in the Finger Lakes is not that we have to watch how little water we have. We have to watch how much water we have, that we get too much.
Right.
So we're usually not looking at things like drought stress, although 2016 was an example of, holy cow, we're going to have to worry about drought stress. But your question generally about remote sensing, I think, is an important one, because it is quickly becoming a tool that is getting used more and more in specialty crops in general. So it's been used in row crops like corn and soybeans and wheat and things like that for a number of years. But it's really starting to just come into its own lately as far as commercial use in vineyards. It's been researched for quite a while. There's actually a couple of projects going on in New York, and I won't go into details about them, but they're looking at using remote sensing technologies to kind of figure out what's going on in a vineyard, and then developing tools, whether it's different machines that can be go through in the vineyard to kind of make adjustments, or just changing practices with your crew in order to respond to those changes that you're seeing. And so there's some things like drought stress, nutrient stress, things like that are possibly able to be seen through remote sensing that we wouldn't be able to see if you're driving by on a tractor or a 4x4.
Before we lose our hour, I want to ask Anna Catherine Mansfield from Cornell Agritech at the New York State Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva. I think Hans can probably weigh in on this as well. If we're seeing more or less in the way of resources, I mean, when I started writing about wine in the region, a lot of people in the industry pointed to Hans as sort of a Mr. Fix-It or someone who had so many great ideas to share. But, you know, there's only one Hans. He's not clonable as far as we know. And Anna Catherine, obviously,
it's another project we're working on.
Yeah. There's so much that you and your teams do for the region, but I'm wondering what the resource sort of equation looks like, Anna Catherine.
That's a complicated question. It does tend to ebb and flow cyclically, depending on, how the federal government feels about agricultural spending at any point in time. So we get a lot of our funding through the Farm Bill, through competitive grants that we get there, and that changes by administration. But there's great state support. I mean, as you've seen, that the governor has had lots of initiatives over the last few years to support craft beverages, and that has helped us in many ways. So I don't have a really, right now it's feeling a little low, but it'll go up again and then go down again.
All right, so 30 seconds. I've got to do this quickly because sparkling wine is the focus of the symposium this week. Kelby Russell, what are you drinking next when you drink a sparkling wine?
Probably Charles Heidsieck from Champagne.
Good for you. Hans Walter Peterson. What's it going to be, Hans?
I actually have a bottle of sparkling Point from Long Island sitting in the fridge waiting for me.
Okay, Dave Wyman?
I'll probably go up to Lucas to get some of theirs.
Very good. And Anna Catherine Mansfield?
I've gotten interested in exploring the world of Pet Nat, which we didn't get to talk about this hour.
Yeah, see, I avoided that because I am not as sanguine as you are in Pet Nat. But, you know, for all the producers of Pet Nat who are listening, they're going to throw arrows at me. Prove it to me! No, it's okay. I'm mostly kidding. There's a great world of Pet Nat out there, and that's a whole other category. And listeners, I know we got a little esoteric, but it was great fun. And this is a region and an industry for our region that is so important. So really appreciate the time from our guests down at WEOS. Anna Catherine Mansfield, thank you, Anna Catherine. Great talking to you.
It was great talking to you.
Hans Walter Peterson, as always, Hans, see you soon. Thank you.
Absolutely, Evan. Thanks a lot.
Dave Wyman from Sheldrake Point, thank you for the expertise. Dave, appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Kelby Russell, thank you, sir, from Red Newt Cellars. Thank you, Kelby.
Thank you.
He's got his own label, too, and you should seek that out. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Megan. I'm Evan. Talk to you Tuesday.